Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red hot hoochie coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. A hide, a hide, a hide, a hide,
hide, hide, hide.
She loved him, though he was cocky. He took her down to Chinatown, and he showed her how to kick the gong around. A hide, a hide, a hide, a hide,
hide, hide, hide.
About the King of Sweden. He gave her things that she was needing. He gave her a home built of gold and steel, a diamond car with the platinum wheels. Hadi, 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 hadi.
Hadi, 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 hadi.
Hadi, 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 hadi. He gave her his townhouse and his racing horses. Each meal she ate was a dozen courses. She had $1 million worth of nickels and dimes. She sat around and counted them all 1 million times. Hide, 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 hide,
hide, hide, hide, hide.
Now I was in Hollywood, and great songwriters sat down to write songs for me, and I was waiting. I was waiting for those beautiful romantic songs. Here's a typical song written for me for one of my Hollywood pictures.
Go see what the boys in the back room will have. Tell them I'm having the same. Go see what the boys in the back room will have. Give them the poison they name. And when I die, don't spend my money on flowers in my picture in a frame. Just see what the boys in the back room will have. Tell them my sight. Tell them I could. And tell them I died of the same. And when I die, casket of silver with the candles all aflame. Just see what the boys in the back room will do. Tell them my sight, tell them I could, and tell them I died of the same. And when I die, don't pay the preacher for speaking of my glory and my fame. Just see what the boys in the back room will hear. Tell them my sight, tell them I could, and tell them I die of the same.
The Greatest Generation lives here on 94.7 KPIP. Listening to 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. Now listen in as resident historian Jim Steele takes us back to days gone by.
For KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back, this is Jim Steele reporting. Well, today, we're looking at a time here in Howard County during the mid-1930s, more than 85 years ago. In doing so, we'll attempt to explain and illustrate just how one federal program in particular went hand in hand with the efforts of local citizens. In doing so, it ultimately made life more meaningful and enjoyable for folks living in this area and beyond. It was on April 8, 1935, that FDR's Works Progress Administration, better known as the WPA, was approved by the Congress. Harry Hopkins is best remembered as the original administrator of the program. The WPA was the largest and most diverse of the New Deal public works efforts and was created in large part to alleviate mass unemployment during the Great Depression. By the time the program was terminated in 1943 during the war, it had put 8.5 million Americans back to work. Most WPA projects built infrastructure needs, such as bridges, airports, schools, highways, and water lines, among many others. The volume and diversity of the WPA was so large and expansive that it included most every kind of imaginable project. We take you now to Fayette, Howard County, Missouri. It was a cool spring day on that first Tuesday in April 1934. Fayette voters that day went to the polls to elect the usual slate of city officials to serve then for the next 2 years. No one who cast a ballot that day could have known that the election results would have historic and far-reaching ramifications for the local community and Howard County. Well, Fayette attorney D.C. Rogers, a 1915 Central Methodist graduate, had already established himself as a mover and shaker locally and statewide. In that city election of 1934, he handily defeated the incumbent mayor to assume the city's top elected position. Immediately, the pages of the Fayette newspapers, there were two at that time, carried word of Rogers' far-reaching ideals for the city, including a major beautification effort and, more importantly, hopes to establish Fayette's first city park and to have a state-of-the-art swimming pool as its centerpiece. News accounts of that period indicate there was near unanimous backing for the plan, and soon a number of residents had agreed to serve on several different planning committees. The rest is history. Today, the pool is particularly significant in that it continues to serve as a long-lived recreational facility built in partnership with public entities during the Great Depression. Funding came from the City of Fayette, the Works Progress Administration, as we noted, WPA, Howard County itself, and the State of Missouri. Architecturally, the pool is distinguished by its Art Deco styling, as well as the unusual above-ground design. The structure was the concept of one Wesley Bentz, a nationally known civic engineer from Lansing, Michigan. He brought to the project his patented Bentz pool design. The facility opened on July 4, 1936, and today remains in use in its original function. As you might expect, the pool's greatest period of significance runs from 1936 until the 1960s, when air conditioning and the availability of other forms of entertainment became commonplace. Well, there were several summers in later years when the pool did not open for whatever reason. Maybe it had lost ground because of maintenance issues. It nonetheless continues today to exhibit a high level of integrity and has seen no major alterations in its construction. It is a rare, intact example of Art Deco architecture in Fayette. The building is also a commemorative property, although not exclusively so. The entrance hall was built to serve as a World War I memorial, and a plaque has been preserved as part of the pool's second-floor observation area. Well, going back, the decision to create an official city park in Fayette more than a century after the town had been incorporated. After discussion began in 1934, the Fayette Board of Aldermen, in other words, the city council, agreed in 1935 to begin acquiring land for a park. This all had come about at the urging of the Fayette Chamber of Commerce and other interested citizens, including the aforementioned Mayor Rogers, who was, by the way, the father of the late Martha Holman, who was well known here in Fayette. On June 18th of that year, the Fayette newspapers reported that, quote, the park proposal has been under lively discussion by the Chamber of Commerce and is the subject of various petitions being considered at length by the aldermen. Although the initial park plans did not include a pool, the decision to build one apparently was made early in the process. Rogers, just the week before, had served as the keynote speaker for the opening of the new pool in Slater, Missouri, and it was noted that a delegation from Fayette had also been invited to be part of the opening of a pool in Higginsville just a few days later. It is very likely that these events encouraged our Fayette leaders. Another deciding factor appears to have been the availability of federal assistance. Depression-era government aid programs were being widely utilized in Missouri at the time on projects which ranged from hand-dug ditches for water mains. Another deciding factor appears to have been the availability of federal assistance. Depression-era government aid programs were being widely utilized in Missouri at the time on various projects, which ranged from hand-dug ditches for water mains to skyscrapers for public offices. The main federal sources of construction for communities during the mid-1930s were two of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal agencies. One was the Public Works Administration, that was for very large projects, and the Works Progress Administration we've been talking about, the WPA. The WPA, as we noted, focused primarily on providing employment for workers who would otherwise be on the relief rolls. Projects, therefore, tended to be labor-intensive. As of December of 1935, nearly two-thirds of most WPA projects were devoted to wages. On the average, WPA funds covered more than 80% of the total cost of a project, with 86% of the funding going to cover payroll expenses. In 1935, the year the pool was started, Missouri had ranked 11th in the nation in the number of WPA workers, with more than 100,000 Missourians on the WPA payrolls. Mayor Rogers, who was active in the politics of municipal administration on a statewide basis, would naturally have been quite familiar with such programs. At the time our park project was being planned, he was the president of the Missouri Mayors Association and was instrumental in arranging a large meeting of that group in Fayette just after the park project had gotten underway. Another well-known civic leader and local Central College professor was Dr. B.I. Lawrence, who also served as an officer in Howard County's Company M of the Missouri National Guard. He, too, was a strong supporter of efforts to develop the city park and the pool. Well, the keynote speaker at the meeting we mentioned was one M.S. Murray, the new head of the Missouri WPA. It was thus logical to assume that Mayor Rogers would have pursued the subject of federal aid for the park during the time Murray was in the area, especially since he'd recently attended the opening of the PWA-funded Higginsville swimming pool. Whatever were the influencing factors, it is known that by the fall of 1935, the construction of the pool had become a key part of the park project, and the WPA had committed to help with the funding. On November the 15th of that year, the Fayette paper reported that 40 men had started on the park swimming pool project, and they noted there was 20 on each job. An additional 20 men were put to work extending a nearby water main. According to the Fayette papers, plans are to proceed at once with the building of the swimming pool. It noted that blueprints will soon be submitted to the council for approval and the actual work to begin. A week later, the city council and other officials heard what the newspaper described as an interesting and intelligent discussion of swimming pools by the nationally known swimming pool designer, Wesley Bintz. Bintz apparently made quite an impression and was hired that same evening, with the aforementioned newspaper featuring a long complimentary account of his presentation. The report also included a fairly detailed discussion of the pool design and noted that officials who heard the proceedings were elated over the fact that Bintz contacted the city at such an appropriate time. It appears that everyone involved was impressed with the above-ground design for the pool, which was said to make it much less expensive to construct. Bintz was confident that he could stay within the approximately $16,000 budget, that's about $33,784 in today's money, was set for the pool project, and they would still end up with a facility big enough to suit the needs of the community. The article went on to note that earlier estimates had rarely been less than $20,000, and the WPA pool in Higginsville had cost nearly $40,000. Even the pool in Slater, which was constructed of used materials, had cost around $12,000. But Bintz was an experienced pool designer. He designed and supervised the construction of swimming pools in several states. Later, he published a promotional booklet, which included photographs, more than a dozen, of his more notable above-ground pools, including the one in Fayette, as well as in several other states. Also, the city of Canton, Illinois, had a Bintz pool similar to the one in Fayette. That structure was demolished in 1992. That pool had a nearly identical shape and layout, as well as the same type of grooved concrete railings and light standards. Promotional literature put out by Bintz in the mid-1940s shows that he was still designing pools, much like the one in Fayette, and listed several of the advantages of building a pool above ground. Now, Bintz not only designed the Fayette pool, he also played an active role in its construction. His contract with the city required on-site supervision as well as building plans, and he was required to make at least 8 trips to Fayette while the pool was under construction. City council meeting records from that period show that he took the responsibility seriously. He appeared before them at least 6 different times to update the aldermen on the project and to discuss various options. As 1935 gave way to a new year, construction moved along quickly at a pace which would be unheard of today. With the coming of the summer months, it became evident that the pool's completion would come none too soon, as that particular summer turned out to be one of the hottest, if not the hottest, on record. The official opening and dedication ceremony took place on Independence Day, July the 4th, 1936. Today, the pool is believed to be one of the few extant bench designs still in use anywhere in the nation, a fact that is a source of pride for Howard County historians and those committed to historic preservation. One who has led many historic preservation efforts over the years is longtime Fayette resident Pam Hutzel. She is credited for her work in leading initiatives to preserve the pool and maintain it in accord with recognized historic preservation standards. As the result of these efforts and the participation of like-minded citizens, a grant was received several years ago from the Missouri State Historic Preservation Office, which permitted tuck pointing and window improvements for the school's headhouse building, which serves as the entrance to the facility. City funds and donations, along with the aforementioned grant, have made it possible for the pool to continue in operation for most summers. 80-year-old machinery such as pumps, filters, electrical wiring, drains, and so forth obviously have required replacing and upgrading, in addition for the need to replace windows and repair leaks in the pool basin. City workers and volunteers have contributed much time and effort over the years. Several years ago, an ad hoc committee was named to promote and assist in pool preservation, in addition to bringing about a kids' splash park adjacent to the pool, and it's hoped that will open this summer. Generally, the pool itself is little changed in its basic design and appearance from that opening day in 1936. Gone, however, are the huge high dive and the long curving slide, no doubt in response to safety and liability concerns. In those early days of the pool's operation, relatively few central Missouri communities had such an outstanding recreational attraction. And so Fayette's facility, with its clear sparkling water, drew huge summer crowds from Howard County and beyond. But with relatively few family fun sites available and home air conditioning virtually non-existent, the pool was a popular venue. However, with the advent of television, electronic games, nearly universal home air conditioning, plus the internet, social media, and various shifts in popular culture, swimming pool usage by area youngsters and adults has to a large degree fallen off from a large number observed in earlier years. Nonetheless, the pool still has its aficionados, and according to city officials, the usage has actually increased slightly during recent summers. For KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back, this is Jim Steele reporting.
That was our Glance Back in Time with Jim Steele, president of the Boonslick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele premieres every Monday at noon and then is rebroadcast Mondays at 4 p.m. and then on Fridays beginning at noon and 4. You're listening to Local Voices, A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP.
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from Old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. It's only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
I'm saving a dime out of every dollar for the family and me to share someday. I'm saving a dime out of every dollar, and we're gonna be free from care that way. I'm buying bonds, I mean war bonds, with 10% of my pay. I'm saving a dime out of every dollar, and I'm helping to save the USA.
I'm saving a dime out of every dollar for the family and me to share someday. I'm saving a dime out of every dollar, and we're gonna be free from care that way. I'm buying bonds, I mean war bonds, with
saving a dime. Out of every dollar, and I'm helping to save the USA. In the good old US way.
Me lending Uncle Sam money sounds funny, but it's true. He could take all I own, but he'd rather take a loan and pay me interest too. I'll never be a millionaire,
but you might call me a civilianaire.
I'm saving a dime out of every dollar for the family and me to share someday. I'm saving a dime out of every dollar,
and we're gonna be free from care that way. We're buying bonds.
By any chance, do you mean war bonds?
Yes, with 10% of our pay.
That's the easy way that I'm saving a dime out of every dollar, and I'm helping to save the USA.
Saving for a rainy day.
I'm buying bonds, I mean war bonds.
War bonds.
With 10% of my pay.
Me to say I'm saving a dime
out of every dollar, and I'm helping to save the USA. I'm helping to save the USA.
This is Local Voices with a glance back at World War II with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
But here's Bing Crosby with a tune they're singing all over the United Nations from Brooklyn to Bombay.
There's a troop ship just leaving Bombay, bound for the blimey shore. Heavily laden with time-expired men, bound for the land they adore. There's many a bloke who has just missed the boat. There's many a lad signing on. But there'll be no promotion this side of the ocean. So cheer up, my lads, bless them all. Bless them all, bless them all. The long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants, the top kickers too. Bless all the corporals, and above all, bless you, for we're saying goodbye to them all. As up the gangway we crawl, no ice cream and cookies for stout-hearted rookies. So cheer up, me lads, bless them all.
They say that in camp you can have a swell time. We've heard it all before.
5 in the morning and you're kicked out of bed to scrub up the barracks room floor.
A private has really no privacy now. We're all behind the 8-ball. No ice cream and cookies for flat-footed rookies.
So cheer up, my lads, bless them all. Bless them all.
Bless them all.
Bless them all. The boys have answered the call. Just to remind them they're on the right track. Stand right behind them and back that attack. That's the least you can do after all. For those who must carry the ball. So keep buying war bonds, buy more and more war bonds. That's how to say bless them all.
Privates and generals, big and small.
That's how to say bless them all.
And you need sympathy, remember me. A smile and a kind word or two will always. always help you through. And so I promise you, I'm yours sincerely. I want you to know I'm really forever. Beside you forever, sincerely yours. If you need a someone to cheer you once in a while, well, here's that someone to help you along with a smile.
Well, on Thursday, September the 11th, 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave the 18th of some 30 public radio speeches that have come to be known as fireside chats. Now, during these radio chats, the president would inform the American people and build public support for his administration's efforts during the Great Depression, World War II, and the enactment of New Deal policies. This is President Roosevelt's 18th fireside chat from September the 11th, 1941, titled On Maintaining Freedom of the Seas and the Greer Incident.
My fellow Americans, the Navy Department of the United States has reported to me that on the morning of September 4th, the United States destroyer Greer, proceeding in full daylight toward Iceland, had reached a point southeast of Greenland. She was carrying American mail to Iceland. She was flying the American flag. Her identity as an American ship was unmistakable. She was then and there attacked by a submarine. Germany admits that it was a German submarine. The submarine deliberately fired a torpedo at the Greer, followed later by another torpedo attack. In spite of what Hitler's propaganda bureau has invented, and in spite of what any American obstructionist organization may prefer to believe, I tell you the blunt fact that the German submarine fired first upon this American destroyer without warning, and with deliberate design to sink her. Our destroyer at the time was in waters which the government of the United States had declared to be waters of self-defense, surrounding outposts of American protection in the Atlantic. In the north of the Atlantic, outposts have been established by us in Iceland, in Greenland, in Labrador, and in Newfoundland. Through these waters there pass many ships of many flags. They bear food and other supplies to civilians, and they bear materiel of war, for which the people of the United States are spending billions of dollars, and which, by congressional action, they have declared to be essential for the defense of our own land. The United States destroyer, when attacked, was proceeding on a legitimate mission. If the destroyer was visible to the submarine when the torpedo was fired, then the attack was a deliberate attempt by the Nazis to sink a clearly identified American warship. On the other hand, if the submarine was beneath the surface of the sea and with the aid of its listening devices fired in the direction of the sound of the American destroyer, without even taking the trouble to learn its identity, as the official German communique would indicate, then the attack was even more outrageous. For it indicates a policy of indiscriminate violence against any vessel sailing the seas, belligerent or non-belligerent. This was piracy. Piracy legally and morally. It was not the first nor the last act of piracy which the Nazi government has committed against the American flag in this war. For attack has followed attack. A few months ago, an American flag merchant ship, the Robin Moore, was sunk by a Nazi submarine in the middle of the South Atlantic under circumstances violating long-established international law. Violating every principle of humanity. The passengers and the crew were forced into open boats, hundreds of miles from land, in direct violation of international agreements signed by nearly all nations, including the government of Germany. No apology, no allegation of mistake, no offer of reparations has come from the Nazi government. In July 1941, nearly 2 months ago, an American battleship in North American waters was followed by a submarine which for a long time sought to maneuver itself into a position of attack upon the battleship. The periscope of the submarine was clearly seen. No British or American submarines were within hundreds of miles of this spot at the time, so the nationality of the submarine is clear. 5 days ago, a United States Navy ship on patrol picked up three survivors of an American-owned ship operating under the flag of our sister Republic of Panama. The steamship Sessa. On August 17th, she had been first torpedoed without warning and then shelled near Greenland while carrying civilian supplies to Iceland. It is feared that the other members of the crew have been drowned. In view of the established presence of German submarines in this vicinity, there can be no reasonable doubt as to the identity of the flag of the attacker. 5 days ago, another United States merchant ship, the Steel Seafarer, was sunk by a German aircraft in the Red Sea, 220 miles south of Suez. She was bound for an Egyptian port. So four of the vessels sunk or attacked flew the American flag and were clearly identifiable. Two of these ships were warships of the American Navy. In the fifth case, the vessel sunk clearly carried the flag of our sister republic of Panama. In the face of all this, we Americans are keeping our feet on the ground. Our type of democratic civilization has outgrown the thought of feeling compelled to fight some other nation by reason of any single piratical attack on one of our ships. We are not becoming hysterical or losing our sense of proportion. Therefore, what I am thinking and saying tonight does not relate to any isolated episode. Instead, we Americans are taking a long-range point of view in regard to certain fundamentals, a point of view in regard to a series of events on land and on sea, which must be considered as a whole, as a part of a world pattern. It would be unworthy of a great nation to exaggerate an isolated incident or to become inflamed by some one act of violence. But it would be inexcusable folly to minimize such incidents in the face of evidence which makes it clear that the incident is not isolated, but is part of a general plan. The important truth is that these acts of international lawlessness are a manifestation of a design that has been made clear to the American people for a long time. It is the Nazi design to abolish the freedom of the seas and to acquire absolute control and domination of these seas for themselves. For with control of the seas in their own hands, the way can obviously become clear for their next step, domination of the United States, domination of the Western Hemisphere by force of arms. Under Nazi control of the seas, no merchant ship of the United States or of any other American republic would be free to carry on any peaceful commerce except by the condescending grace of this foreign and tyrannical power. The Atlantic Ocean, which has been and which should always be a free and friendly highway for us, would then become a deadly menace to the commerce of the United States, to the coasts of the United States, and even to the inland cities of the United States. The Hitler government, in defiance of the laws of the sea, in defiance of the recognized rights of all other nations, has presumed to declare on paper that great areas of the seas, even including a vast expanse lying in the Western Hemisphere, are to be closed, and that no ships may enter them for any purpose except at peril of being sunk. Actually, they are sinking ships at will and without warning in widely separated areas, both within and far outside of these far-flung pretended zones. This Nazi attempt to seize control of the oceans is but a counterpart of the Nazi plots now being carried on throughout the Western Hemisphere, all designed toward the same end. For Hitler's advance guards, not only his avowed agents, but also his dupes among us, have sought to make ready for him footholds, bridgeheads in the New World, to be used as soon as he has gained control of the oceans. His intrigues, his plots, his machinations, his sabotage in this new world are all known to the government of the United States. Conspiracy has followed conspiracy. For example, last year a plot to seize the government of Uruguay was smashed by the prompt action of that country, which was supported in full by her American neighbors. A like plot was then hatching in Argentina, and that government has carefully and wisely blocked it at every point. More recently, an endeavor was made to subvert the government of Bolivia. And within the past few weeks, the discovery was made of secret air landing fields in Colombia, within easy range of the Panama Canal. I could multiply instance upon instance. To be ultimately successful in world mastery, Hitler knows that he must get control of the seas. He must first destroy the bridge of ships, which we are building across the Atlantic, and over which we shall continue to roll the implements of war to help destroy him, to destroy all his works in the end. He must wipe out on sea if he is to do it. Silence. Think it must be over and over again to people who the United States as an invincible, that this can only fish navy survive, and that is simple. Outside of the Isles under Axis domination, the shipbuilding facilities which the Axis powers would then possess in all of Europe, in the British Isles, and in the Far East would be much greater than all the shipbuilding facilities and potentialities of all of the Americas. Not only greater, but 2 or 3 times greater, enough to win. Even if the United States threw all its resources into such a situation, seeking to double and even redouble the size of our Navy, the Axis powers in control of the rest of the world would have the manpower and the physical resources to outbuild us several times over. It is time for all Americans, Americans of all the Americas, to stop being deluded by the romantic notion that the Americas can go on living happily and peacefully in a Nazi-dominated world. Generation after generation, America has battled for the general policy of the freedom of the seas. And that policy is a very simple one, but a basic, a fundamental one. It means that no nation has the right to make the broad oceans of the world, at great distances from the actual theater of land war, unsafe for the commerce of others. That has been our policy, proved time and again in all of our history. Our policy is applied from the earliest days of the Republic and still applies, not merely to the Atlantic, but to the Pacific and to all other oceans as well. Unrestricted submarine warfare in 1941 constitutes a defiance, an act of aggression against that historic American policy. It is now clear that Hitler has begun his campaign to control the seas by ruthless force and by wiping out every vestige of international law, every vestige of humanity. His intention has been made clear. The American people can have no further illusions about it. No tender whisperings of appeasers that Hitler is not interested in the Western Hemisphere. No soporific lullabies that a wide ocean protects us from him can long have any effect on the hard-headed, far-sighted, and realistic American people. Because of these episodes, because of the movements and operations of German warships, and because of the clear, repeated proof that the present government of Germany has no respect for treaties or for international law, that it has no decent attitude toward neutral nations or human life, we Americans are now face to face, not with abstract theories, but with cruel, relentless fact. This attack on the Greer was no localized military operation in the North Atlantic. This was no mere episode in a struggle between two nations. This was one determined step toward creating a permanent world system based on force, on terror, and on murder. And I am sure that even now the Nazis are waiting to see whether the United States will, by silence, give them the green light to go ahead on this path of destruction. The Nazi danger to our Western world has long ceased to be a mere possibility. The danger is here now, not only from a military enemy, but from an enemy of all law, all liberty, all morality, all religion. There has now come a time when you and I must see the cold, inexorable necessity of saying to these inhuman, unrestrained seekers of world conquest and permanent world domination by the sword, you seek to throw our children and our children's children into your form, of terrorism and slavery. You have now attacked our own safety. You shall go no further. Normal practices of diplomacy, note writing, are of no possible use in dealing with international outlaws who sink our ships and kill our citizens. One peaceful nation after another has met disaster because each refused to look the Nazi danger squarely in the eye until it had actually had them by the throat. The United States will not make that fatal mistake. No act of violence, no act of intimidation will keep us from maintaining intact two bulwarks of American defense. First, our line of supply of material to the enemies of Hitler. And second, the freedom of our shipping on the high seas. No matter what it takes, no matter what it costs, we will keep open the line of legitimate commerce in these defensive waters of ours. We have sought no shooting war with Hitler. We do not seek it now. But neither do we want peace so much that we are willing to pay for it by permitting him to attack our naval and merchant ships while they are on legitimate business. I assume that the German leaders are not deeply concerned tonight or any other time by what we Americans or the American government says or publishes about them. We cannot bring about the downfall of Nazism by the use of long-range invective. But when you see a rattlesnake poised to strike, you do not wait until he has struck before you crush him. These Nazi submarines and raiders are the rattlesnakes of the Atlantic. They are a menace to the free pathways of the high seas. They are a challenge to our own sovereignty. They hammer at our most precious rights when they attack ships of the American flag, symbols of our independence, our freedom, our very life. It is clear to all Americans that the time has come when the Americas themselves must now be defended. A continuation of attacks in our own waters, or in waters that could be used for further and greater attacks on us, will inevitably weaken our American ability to repel Hitlerism. Do not let us be hair splitters. Let us not ask ourselves whether the Americas should begin to defend themselves after the first attack, or the fifth attack, or the tenth attack, or the 20th attack. The time for active defense is now. Do not let us split hairs. Let us not say we will only defend ourselves if the torpedo succeeds in getting home, or if the crew and the passengers are drowned. This is the time for prevention of attack. If submarines or raiders attack in distant waters, they can attack equally well within sight of our own shores. Their very presence in any waters which America deems vital to its defense constitutes an attack. In the waters which we deem necessary for our defense, American naval vessels and American planes will no longer wait until Axis submarines lurking under the water or Axis raiders on the surface of the sea strike their deadly blow first. Upon our naval and air patrol, now operating in large number over a vast expanse of the Atlantic Ocean, falls the duty of maintaining the American policy of freedom of the seas now. That means, very simply, very clearly, that our patrolling vessels and planes protect all merchant ships. Not only American ships, but ships of any flag engaged in commerce in our defensive waters. They will protect them from submarines. They will protect them from surface raiders. This situation is not new. The second of the United States, John Adams, ordered the United States Navy to clean out European privateers and European ships of war which were infesting the Caribbean and South American waters, destroying American commerce. The third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, ordered the United States Navy to end the attacks being made upon American and other ships by the corsairs of the nations of North Africa. My obligation as president is historic. It is clear. Yes, it is inescapable. It is no act of war on our part when we decide to protect the seas that are vital to American defense. The aggression is not ours. Ours is solely defense. But let this warning be clear. From now on, if German or Italian vessels of war enter the waters, the protection of which is necessary for American defense, they do so at their own peril. The orders which I have given as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army and Navy are to carry out that policy at once. The sole responsibility rests upon Germany. There will be no shooting unless Germany continues to seek it. That is my obvious duty in this crisis. That is the clear right of this sovereign nation. This is the only step possible if we would keep tight the wall of defense which we are pledged to maintain around this Western Hemisphere. I have no illusions about the gravity of this step. I have not taken it hurriedly or lightly. It is the result of months and months of constant thought and anxiety and prayer. In the protection of your nation and mine, it cannot be avoided. The American people have faced other grave crises in their history. With American courage, with American resolution, they will do no less today. They know the actualities of the attacks upon us. They know the necessities of a bold defense against these attacks. They know that the times call for clear heads and fearless hearts. And with that inner strength that comes to a free people conscious of their duty, consciousness, conscious of the righteousness of what they do, they will, with divine help and guidance, stand their ground against this latest assault upon their democracy, their sovereignty, and their freedom.
That was President Franklin Roosevelt's 18th fireside chat from Thursday, September the 11th, 1941. It was titled On Maintaining Freedom of the Seas and the Greer Incident. Next week, we'll explore FDR's 19th fireside chat from Tuesday, December 9th, 1941, titled On the Declaration of War with Japan. And I'm Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.